Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Isaacs of the Council for a Livable World, who discusses progress made in recent U.S.-Russian arms control talks. Jim Lyons, Vice President for Policy and Communications with Oxfam America, who talks about the outcome of the G8 summit's negotiations on climate change and the links between global warming and hunger. And Judy Bonds, co-director of Coal River Mountain Watch, who talks about the escalating campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in America's southern mining communities. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
China has mobilized a massive crackdown in the western province of Xinjiang as ethnic Muslim Uyghur rioting broke out against the Han, China's dominant ethnic group. According to the state news agency, 156 people were killed in the initial outbreak of violence and more than 1,000 people were injured. The riots occurred in the provincial capital of Yiramji. China quickly sent in 20,000 troops to stop the ethnic violence and cut off internet and mobile phone service to the region. The unrest started after local police confronted a Uyghur protest march calling for an official investigation into a fight between Uyghurs and Han Chinese at a toy factory in late June. According to the New York Times, the fight started when a former factory worker spread a rumor that 6 Uyghur men had raped 2 Han Chinese women at the factory. In a sign of the severity of the ethnic unrest, China's president, Hu Jintao, left the G8 summit in Italy early to deal with his nation's worst ethnic violence in decades. In the days after the outbreak, Han Chinese retaliated against Uyghur businesses and mosques. Right after World War II, Uyghurs created the independent state of East Turkmenistan, but it was taken over by the People's Republic of China in 1949. Since the 1990s, a growing number of Uyghur activists have been arrested or forced into exile. Mexican President Felipe Calderón of the Conservative National Action Party, or PAN, suffered a considerable defeat in midterm congressional elections when the former ruling party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI, won dozens of seats in Congress and now holds a majority of state governors. The economic downturn and growing drug violence influenced the outcome of the elections. Over 11,000 people have been killed since Calderón took office in late 2006. In recent months, Mexico's Congress approved a plan to decriminalize possession of small amounts of illegal drugs, but the proposal submitted by President Calderón fell far short of the goals of drug reform groups. Critics from the small PSD, Partido Social Demócrata, say the amounts decriminalized are so small that most addicts will be prosecuted as drug dealers and face stiff sanctions. Meanwhile, President Obama is gearing up to put more agents on Mexico's border to fight drug trafficking. The administration is also recruiting 1,500 National Guard volunteers from 4 border states to work on anti-drug surveillance, intelligence, and aviation support. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has formally opposed a move to tax health care benefits to raise $320 billion to pay for health reform over the next decade. A proposal by Senate Finance Chair Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana, would tax health care benefits above $17,000 a year. Baucus is negotiating with a number of Senate Republicans, including Charles Grassley of Iowa, on drafting health reform legislation. Taxing health care benefits is highly unpopular, and industrial unions have pledged to challenge senators, Democrat or Republican, who vote for taxing health insurance. The House Ways and Means Committee has proposed a surtax on people making over $280,000 a year to pay for health reform. The bill would raise $550 billion over 10 years. The Obama administration has negotiated deals with hospitals and drug makers to agree to over $200 billion in savings to pay for health reform initiatives. Last fall, candidate Barack Obama blasted his rival John McCain for advocating taxing health benefits to pay for expanded health care, and the president recently has restated his opposition to such attacks. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
President Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, after meeting in Moscow on July 6th, signed a joint preliminary agreement to work toward cutting the number of deployed nuclear warheads to between 1,500 and 1,675 within 7 years, a reduction from the previous ceiling of 2,200. The leaders also agreed to limit the number of land-based intercontinental missiles, submarine-based missiles, and bombers to between 500 and 1,100, down from the previous limit of 1,600 delivery vehicles. The U.S.-Russian agreement, if ratified by the U.S. Senate, would replace the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, which expires in December. Mr. Obama will host a nuclear security summit meeting in Washington next March, where he hopes to make more substantial cuts in the world's nuclear arsenal and limit proliferation. While the two leaders agreed to fight the proliferation of nuclear weapons in Iran and North Korea, Mr. Medvedev and Mr. Obama did not resolve their own nation's differences over the U.S. plan to deploy a missile defense system in Poland and the Czech Republic, initiated under the Bush administration to deter a future missile threat from Iran. Russia strongly opposes the plan as a threat to its security. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Isaacs, Executive Director and President of the Council for a Livable World and Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, who outlines the progress made in Moscow and the reasons why the U.S. and Russia live with the legacy of the Cold War more than 18 years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union.
We're coming off an 8-year period where the United States and Russia were at loggerheads on many issues. We know President Bush said he saw into the soul of Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the two sides had disagreements on many issues. So one thing Barack Obama promised to do is try to rebuild relations with Russia. It's better to be talking with them than squabbling with them. The two leaders met briefly at a summit, at a meeting in April, and then more thoroughly last week and had a longer conversation. The most significant achievement was an agreement to proceed with further nuclear weapons reduction. Now, despite the end of the Cold War, both Russia and the United States each has deployed more than 2,000 nuclear warheads and many more nuclear warheads in storage or ready that could be used in a short while. Each one of these nuclear weapons, each bomb we have, is almost every one of them is larger than those that destroyed two Japanese cities at the end of World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So again, over 2,000 deployed nuclear weapons, much larger than those that destroyed two Japanese cities. The two countries agreed at the summit meeting last week that they would complete an agreement by December of this year, December 2009. That date is important because the previous major arms control agreement, so-called START or Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, was an agreement concluded in 1991, expires in December. And that agreement, besides setting various limits on both nuclear weapons, as well as the missiles and the launchers that would send those nuclear warheads at each other, also that treaty had a lot of verification procedures, so each side knew what the other was doing. That treaty, all those verification procedures would expire in December if there's no new agreement. But Presidents Obama and Medvedev agreed that they would conclude another agreement by December in which they'd make reductions perhaps to maybe 1,500, 1,675 deployed nuclear warheads, strategic warheads. And that's a good reduction of nuclear weapons. Remember that the two countries, the United States and Russia, between them have about 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. I would argue that even 1,500 nuclear weapons is much too large, and we can go for further reductions later on, and the two countries have said they'll do so. But this is an excellent start, and it's good that the two countries are talking to each other again as well as just squabbling.
John Isaacs, as I understand it, there are a lot of conservative politicians in this country that are opposed to linking U.S. missile defense programs to any agreement to reduce offensive weapons. And I wonder if you would talk about the Obama administration's attitude towards a project begun under President Bush, which was the deployment of an anti-missile system, a radar, and missile launchers in Eastern Europe, specifically in Poland and the Czech Republic, that has been very controversial in Russia. Has Obama stepped back from that in any way, shape, or form in these negotiations?
I think the best way to to talk about it is to say that the Obama administration has really kicked the issue down the road. First of all, the United States is in the middle of a review, both of nuclear weapons as well as anti-missile systems. And that review probably will not be concluded until about December. At the same time, we face the deadline for the Strategic Arms Limitation Agreement of December 2009. So there's no way, really, that the United States will make a final decision on deploying interceptor missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic. And I think the Russians are very unhappy with the U.S. deployment, but one of the factors is that even under the best of circumstances, it'll be another 2-3 years before the United States could actually deploy some missiles in Poland and the Czech Republic. We haven't even built the missiles that would be deployed there, much less tested them. Now, President George W. Bush promised Poland and the Czech Republic that we would deploy those interceptor missiles there, despite Russian feelings. But I would say right now the issue is on hold. I don't know if you'd say Obama's set back from it, but he's really postponed a decision until later. Because there's a question whether the missile will work, whether it'll be cost-effective, and whether it's worth all the trouble. Those decisions, I think, can be put down the road, and I think the Russians will accept that the missile defense issue will have to be worked out, but not this first round of negotiations on cutting nuclear weapons.
Despite the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the ostensible end of the Cold War, it seems like we're still living out the Cold War, that in terms of U.S. policy towards Russia and this, thousands of nuclear missiles on a hair trigger alert, that we really haven't put the Cold War behind us. Why is that?
I think you're correct, and I think there's a couple different factors involved. The Clinton administration could have reduced nuclear weapons more, but they had other priorities, mainly economic problems. And the Bush administration came in 2001 and really liked nuclear weapons and sought additional roles for nuclear weapons. So it wasn't interested in too much of a drastic change from the end of the Cold War. And I think it's just countries are very slow to change policies. I know we're almost 20 years after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, yet we still have thousands of nuclear warheads. And again, that's a legacy of the Cold War, and countries take a long time to change policies. When circumstances change, countries, corporations, and even individuals are sometimes very slow to react and make the changes that would be commensurate with the changes and the circumstance around them.
That was John Isaacs, Executive Director and President of the Council for a Livable World and Executive Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Contact the Council by calling area code 202-543-4100 or visit their website at livableworld.org. While the world is increasingly focusing on the issue of climate change and its consequences, many people don't fully understand the links between global warming and world hunger. The shifting seasons and severe weather, such as drought and floods, are responsible for destroying agricultural harvests, which in turn exacerbate hunger and increase poverty. When the world's leading industrial nations met in Italy for the G8 summit, they declined to commit themselves to adopting higher taxes and energy prices to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming. The wealthiest nations set a goal of reducing their own emissions by 80% and worldwide emissions by 50% by the year 2050, but without outlining the steps necessary to achieve that goal. India and China rejected that proposal, arguing that they would bear an unfair burden as their economies are expanding to catch up with the West. Nations at the G8 summit issued a declaration that they would work to limit global warming to 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial temperatures, a level scientists assert would minimize the worst effects of climate change. Ongoing talks on the issue of global warming will culminate at a United Nations climate conference in Copenhagen this December. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jim Lyons, Vice President for Policy and Communications with Oxfam America, who talks about the outcome of the G8 summit negotiations on climate change and the links between global warming and hunger.
There's been a continuing disagreement about how to achieve the reductions in CO2 emissions that are necessary to avoid the continued impact of global warming, which is now being felt across the globe. Those disagreements center around how large the emission reduction should be in particular countries, particularly in the developed world, which is responsible for most of the emissions, and also how to help developing countries both deal with the consequences of climate change that they're feeling, while at the same time realizing their desire to be able to grow and develop as developed nations have, so as to ensure that as they grow, they don't further contribute to greenhouse gases and to global warming. Basically, what the G8 collectively agreed to was an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions over the next 40 years, so as to limit overall temperature increases to less than 4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 2 degrees Celsius above 1990 levels. That was the good news. The bad news is that how we get there, what developed nations and developing nations will need to do to avoid exceeding that 2-degree mark has not yet been agreed to, although President Obama and the G8 leaders committed to work between now and the international meeting in Copenhagen when negotiations are intended to come to resolution and agreement reached on a post-2012 climate agreement when they will occur.
Jim, when it comes to the developing nations of the world, there are some leaders of the industrial nations who cast blame on the developing world for not coming up with a stronger agreement on addressing global climate change. What's your response on that?
Well, I think you can understand the position of the developing world, countries like China and India, Brazil, who are realizing growth. China, obviously, substantial economic growth. Still have millions of people who live in poverty. Their per capita emissions of greenhouse gases are considerably less than developed countries like the United States, which happens to have the highest per capita emissions. So there's a great deal of hesitancy on the part of the developing countries to commit to a cap on emissions, which would affect them, for fear it could thwart their efforts to try and raise their own populations out of poverty and to realize some of the gains and benefits that we recognize and appreciate here in the developed world. I think a great deal of the debate obviously centers around the role of China, you know, a growing economy, and with that growth, they've been accused of adding to greenhouse gas emissions by building coal-fired power plants to fuel their economy. I think what's significant is that China is in fact also growing in the development of green technologies and technologies that will realize or produce less greenhouse gas emissions based on renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, and the like. But this has been an area of disagreement and obviously continues to be an area of disagreement since the developing countries represented at the Italian G8 meeting were unwilling to commit to a cap on emissions unless they received assistance in developing the green technologies that would allow their economies to grow without increasing their emissions. And they received assistance in dealing with the consequences of climate change, which heretofore they've been least responsible for, but unfortunately, given their economic circumstances, are most vulnerable to.
Jim Lyons, there are over 1 billion people around the world that go to bed hungry every night. And if you could explain to our listeners a bit about the link between problems and failures of agriculture around the world and climate change.
With climate change, there's been increased recognition that agriculture will suffer. And in fact, across Africa, we've estimated that 75 to 250 million people could face severe water shortages by 2020, one of the consequences of climate change. Now, obviously, water is essential for agricultural production, and severe weather, droughts, or even floods in certain circumstances could destroy any effort for people to feed themselves. So dealing with climate change and at the same time providing assistance to help small communities in developing countries develop the infrastructure and the capacity to feed themselves is critical. So the two issues are clearly linked, and it's essential that development assistance and a commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions work hand in hand if people are ever going to be able to lift themselves out of poverty and begin to feed themselves.
That was Jim Lyons, Vice President for Policy and Communications with Oxfam America. Contact Oxfam by calling 1-800-77-OXFAM or visit their website at OxfamAmerica.org. In late June, the years-long struggle of people in Appalachia to stop mountaintop removal coal mining grabbed some headlines when prominent climate scientist James Hansen and actress Daryl Hannah were arrested along with others protesting the practice. The burning of coal contributes the greatest proportion of greenhouse gases of any energy source in the U.S. But literally blowing the tops off mountains to mine the coal seams and dumping tons of debris in local streams has created a nightmare for residents of West Virginia and other states where the practice continues. And the Supreme Court recently ruled in a case from Alaska that dumping toxic debris in streams does not violate the Clean Water Act. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Judy Bonds, co-director of Coal River Mountain Watch in West Virginia. She is the daughter and granddaughter of miners and has been in the forefront of trying to stop mountaintop removal mining. For her efforts, she was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize in 2003. In a recent protest against the Massey Coal Company, she was attacked by a Massey supporter and suffered a serious neck injury. She describes what it's like to live with constant blasting and the water and air contamination that accompany surface mining and what people living in Appalachia are doing about it.
They're using 3.5 million pounds of explosives a day just in West Virginia and another 3.5 million pounds in Kentucky to blow the tops off our mountains and cover up our streams. It poisons our water, poisons our air. It's destroying our whole mountain, all of our mountains and our culture and our heritage of mountain folk. So that's basically what we've been doing for about the last 11 years. Here in West Virginia, and there's activists in Kentucky and Tennessee and Virginia that's taken up the fight as well. And basically, we're literally fighting for our lives, literally fighting for our lives. And we also are fighting for clean water for all of America because of a President Bush change in the Clean Water Act. Now a lake, a pristine lake in Alaska, is being contaminated. That gold company is allowed to dump that waste there because of the rule change that President Bush made in order to for mountaintop removal coal mining to be able to continue on. So it's a cause and effect of what's happening in Appalachia. So it's not just our water here in Appalachia. It's your water, too, in America.
I know you've been at this a long time. It's been a long struggle, but it's really intensified this year, hasn't it?
Absolutely, things have intensified this past year, and it's because the coal industry and the coal companies are inciting their workers to violence against activists, nonviolent activists, I might add. I think they see that they're losing, that it's inevitable that America will allow human beings to be blasted by 3.5 million pounds of explosives daily. Americans see the horror of mountaintop removal and think it's disgusting. And we're close to ending mountaintop removal, and the industry sees that. So they are inciting violence, inciting their workers to violence against local activists like myself, against anyone that is involved in trying to get clean air and clean water and save our children's earth that they live on. In the last month, it's been ramped up a lot because of the nonviolent civil disobedience on top of the sites by people that are able to climb high walls and climb drag lines. Not all of us can climb a high wall on a mountain. And so that seems to have infuriated the workers on the site.
Judy Bonds, you say you've almost won. What's changed?
The reason I say we've almost won is because we now have a president and an EPA that is looking at science and that is looking at literally stopping mountaintop removal in its tracks. We have two bills in Congress now. We have a much more raised awareness in America about what's going on, and indeed even celebrities are coming to get arrested. They recognize this for the atrocity and the crime that it is. And that's what I mean by we're winning. We're winning. And you know, with the last few years, very few people knew about mountaintop removal. Now a lot of people know about mountaintop removal. A lot of people are outraged about mountaintop removal and just can't believe, oh my gosh, they're blowing up mountains in West Virginia. Why would anybody do that? And so, again, that's my feelings on why I think we're very close to winning this battle.
Do you know what percent of coal is mined this way in Appalachia and what percent is underground mined?
Well, I really don't think it matters how much coal is mined by mountaintop removal mining. No coal is worth blowing up people's homes and poisoning our land, air, and water. This is a human rights issue as well as an environmental issue. All that coal that they're mining by surface mining has our blood on it.
You know, ever since Mississippi Freedom Summer brought thousands of people from all over the country down to the South to work for voting rights in the early 1960s, there have been other summers that have focused on various other issues. There was Redwood Summer in the 1990s and to protect the redwoods in California. Do you have a similar thing where you're asking people to come from all over and help protect the mountains in Appalachia?
We've had Mountain Justice Summer going on since 2005, and that is a call for people to come to Appalachia, or they can participate from their own home, because with the Internet and with technology now, it's not necessary to come to Appalachia unless you want to. There are many things that people can do from their own home in order to help us out. But, yes, we do have a program called Mountain Justice Summer, and it's based on nonviolence, and it has listening projects. It's documenting the damage and the blasting and poisoning of the people here in Appalachia. It's about helping people, local people, write letters and giving them the tools that they need to fight this battle as well. I think it's a victory for all of America to stand up and demand clean, safe, renewable energy and jobs for our children's future.
That was Judy Bonds, co-director of Coal River Mountain Watch. Contact the group at area code 304-854-2182 or visit their website at crmw.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.